Hello, Internet, and welcome back to another episode of Old Geek, Young Geek. I am Scott Pell, the Young Geek. With me, as always, is Steven Johnson. Today,
hello.
And today, our special guest is Maximilian Lopez.
How's it going, guys?
All right.
Max is an animator. He works for BixPix Entertainment, and he is an animator on the stop-motion animation program Tumbleleaf, which is on Amazon.
Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
Cool.
It's a pretty cute little preschool series. We're going strong in our second season right now. Just picked up the Annie Award for Best Preschool Series.
So that's pretty amazing.
For the second time in a row, in fact.
Oh, you guys won another Annie. I didn't even know that.
To toot their horn. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. How many Emmys did you win last time there were Emmys?
Jeez, I think it was five.
We won. That's amazing.
Yeah, preschool series, color, character design. Oh, there's two more. Yeah, too many to count, apparently.
That is very – so Tumbleleaf is doing very, very well by all – if you count awards, it's doing well.
It's doing well for itself, and I think it's pretty popular on Amazon Prime, so I think it's doing good.
And I find it really interesting that the last time I was at the just for full disclosure's sake, my wife does the costumes on Tumbleleaf. So I've been to BixPix any number of times, and the last time I was there, I was remarking about how amazing it is that anyone does stop motion animation, because it is such an exacting process compared to easier, in quote, kinds of animation like computer animation. So, Max, can you talk a little bit about what advantages stop motion animation offers over computer animation?
Well, you know, I think I'd say that any form of animation is just by design meticulous and detail oriented. The difference is that in computer animation, it's much easier to go in after the fact and fine tune and tweak this and change that. The process stays very fluid, whereas once you've committed stop-motion animation, it is set in stone. But the advantage to stop-motion, there's a few advantages, I would say, one of which being that while CG is often striding to look real, you know, Pixar a couple years ago produced a short film, I believe it was called Blue Umbrella, is that true? Where they were striving for realism. And so the beauty of stop motion is the realism is inherent. Furthermore, I think there's something to be said about that hand-touched look that can't necessarily be reproduced. You know, there's a certain way that the light catches hair on Fig's head, or the shine of like off of like a metallic object that I think your brain recognizes when it's actually looking at the real deal.
Yeah, it's true.
And so that gives us a lot of opportunity to play. You know, what's great about Tumbleleaf, what I love about that show is that it's very textural. You know, Pine the Porcupine wears a knitted vest, and you can tell that the stitches are there. There's the fur, there's like the fuzz sticking up off the yarn that lets you know that that is a handcrafted piece of clothing.
Hmm.
So for me, that's always been the draw, is that it's rooted in, you know, real life materials and the practical skills that go along with producing that kind of work.
Yeah, one thing about Tumbleleaf that I love is it's clear from looking at the show that everyone who works on the show is really at the top of their game. Like, this is the best of the best, you guys. And you probably don't think of it that way because they're just the people that you work with. But looking at it from an outsider's perspective, it's just remarkable what you guys do. I mean, it's like, it's transcendental often. It's so amazing.
I mean, I'm so lucky because I can just, at any given time, I can walk around and pick anybody's brain. And nobody really holds back. Everybody is excited that you're excited, you know?
Yeah, that's the other thing about BixPix that I find remarkable. Different than probably most people's places of employment is everybody seems really happy to be there. Like, everybody's like, yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah, stop motion really attracts a passionate type of person. You don't go into stop motion to get famous. You do it because you love what you do.
You don't go into it to get rich? Come on.
No, you know, I tried at first. Don't think that's really the right avenue.
Hey, speaking of getting into stop motion animation, you're a younger guy. Can you tell us how old you are? Would you?
Yeah, I'm 25 years old.
Okay, so that you have a sort of a dream job for somebody of any age. How did you get started in animation? Like, how did your career get started?
You know, I think I had a pretty roundabout path. I always loved working with my hands. I wanted to build things and get messy. In high school, I was on stage crew, so I was used to working with, you know, it's interesting, a lot of ways theater and stop motion have overlapped. So I feel like that, you know, you're setting a stage, you're lighting it in a, like, whereas live action, the lighting's always changing. When you're lighting for theater, it's set. So there were a lot of factors that kind of, like, guided me in that direction. But actually, initially, I thought I wanted to be an engineer. I thought, oh, working with your hands, making stuff, that's an engineer, right? So I started learning AutoCAD and other architectural design programs, trying to move in that direction. But I started to realize that as an engineer, you're only really designing things. You're not so much actually getting your hands dirty building them. And so when I realized that, I was like, well, this is not the right direction. But I'd already been messing with modeling programs, so I was like, maybe 3D animation. So I went to school for 3D animation and almost immediately got the opportunity to touch a puppet and was like, nope, this is it. This is what I should be doing.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it kind of was a little roundabout, but ultimately I realized, and I had always, as a child, I had done like home stop motion movies, and I basically had just forgotten that that was ever part of my childhood. Mm-hmm. So it was a very roundabout path, but yeah, ultimately it was just the drive to get my hands dirty and build things. I'm lucky enough that I animate, but I also get to be on puppet crews. I get to build the puppets.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I really get to fulfill all of my get your hands dirty impulses. It's great.
Sure. So when you were in school, did you like make animated films in college, or did you wait until after school, or how did you actually hook up with Bix Pix?
So I went to school for animation. I made a handful of films, and then I got to a point in college where I was like, well, I'm going to have to find a job, so I guess I should start looking. And through some investigating and through some interning, I realized that all the jobs were in Los Angeles. So the moment I graduated, I packed up my bags and I moved out here, aspiring to be an animator. And I actually, by chance, in college, I took a lot of metalworking classes because I was like, I don't know, puppet building, metal, maybe that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I got out here and just got job after job in stop motion based purely on my metalworking skills. So Tumbleleaf actually hired me specifically to be an armaturist because they knew that I could build ball and socket armatures. And it wasn't until I was in there that they were like, oh, so rumor has it you can animate too. One thing led to another, and now I've been animating on this season for about a year now.
Oh, that's cool. Who else have you worked for out here in Los Angeles that people might have seen or heard of? Or
I worked for a studio called Shadow Machine, which they produced the first, I want to say, like 6 seasons or so of Robot Chicken. I worked recently on a short film called Anomalisa, which is currently nominated for an Oscar.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh wow, you worked on that movie? The one with, that was directed by, I'm forgetting his name.
Charlie Kaufman, yeah.
That's the guy.
Yep.
Wow.
That guy.
I hear that movie's amazing. I haven't seen it yet, but I hear incredibly good things about it.
You know, I honestly haven't seen it either. The last time I saw it was a long time ago, and it did not look how it looks now. but yeah, I was working there, but not for too long before Bix Pix snatched me up, and then the rest has been Tumbleleaf history.
There you go.
Yeah, it has not been too shabby.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm still here. I'm just listening.
No, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. So growing up, you apparently made stop motion films like as a kid.
Yeah, like little Lego character movies. Specifically, I used Bionicles for anybody out there who knows what I'm talking about, because they were basically built to be little ball and socket puppets. They're
yeah,
amazing.
That's basically how they operated, and yeah, I collected all of those.
Oh yeah.
So like, why stop motion? I mean, like, you appreciate the authenticity of it, like how real it looks, like with the genuine lighting and the actual figurines. Like, when I think of stop motion, I think of stuff like Nightmare Before Christmas or something like Fantastic Mr. Fox. What were some favorites of yours that sort of inspired you to go in this direction of stop motion?
You know, whenever I talk to other animators who are friends of mine, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, this one Eastern European guy really inspired me because of the raw, visceral nature of his materials, and I'm just like, you know, I just really liked Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
That was the one that did it for me.
You're not like a Jan Svankmajer guy, or a Quaid brother?
You know, Jan's got his place. I give him respect, but but yeah, you know, I grew up every Thanksgiving for whatever reason. We watched Nightmare Before Christmas, and I remember that the first few years, it was a very odd and jarring experience. That's a very weird film.
Yes, it is.
But after a while, it just kind of like rooted itself in my brain. There was just something about it. In my mind, stop motion is almost like the ultimate magic trick. And I was always obsessed with magic. And so what is more magic than bringing an inanimate object to life, you know?
Yeah.
Giving it thoughts and feelings. So for me, there was something amazing just about that illusion. So when I was doing little videos as a kid, I was always trying to do like stop motion effects into like a live action film. So it'd be like me and my friends being chased by a giant bionicle chasing us down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So kind of like the old Jason the Argonauts film.
Exactly, yeah. The effects animation is really what stood out to me.
Yeah, wow. That's really cool, and I feel as though stop motion may be either overlooked or underappreciated, because like if you watch like a special features on, you know, say Nightmare Before Christmas or, you know, other stop motion films, like you see all the work that goes into just one character moving for like 60 seconds or even 30 seconds. Like it takes so much work just to get that. So on Tumbleleaf, how, like, you do all the animations. So about like a 5 minute scene or so, if something lasts that long, like what's the process of, you know, doing that? And is it like an all day project just to get like one shot done?
Well, so the pace that we move at is about 8 seconds a day per person.
Wow.
And that's in ideal situations.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to find yourself going down to 5 seconds. If it's on a feature film, you might be doing 3 seconds a day.
Mm.
So it's definitely takes its time.
Yeah.
And that's only the animating, you know.
Yeah.
Up until that point, there's been a whole elaborate process happening behind the scenes to get to the point where you could animate finally.
Yeah. Is that at all defeating? Like at the end of the day, like, man, I only did like 5 seconds of capture today, or?
I think it's kind of like a half glass full, half empty kind of thing. From the outside, you see that 8 seconds got complete and you're like, man, you didn't really do anything today.
Yeah.
But from the inside, where you know how painstaking animation can be and like how much of a battle each frame can be to get it just right, 8 seconds can feel pretty triumphant, actually.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
Yeah. I've been animating cotton a lot. And cotton, as you might imagine, is not necessarily made for animation. So at the end of the day, when you've made cotton do what you were trying, you don't care how many seconds you got. You're just glad that it doesn't look like a jumbled mess of cotton.
Yeah.
Looks like a cloud or some smoke or something. Right?
Exactly, yeah.
So what kind of materials do you work with on a daily basis?
Well, you know, everybody always asks, oh, so the puppets must be clay, right? But in actuality, the puppets are a complex mixture of steel ball and socket armatures with foam and latex to build up the body. The heads are hard plastic. You know, the clothes are all made from like very particularly selected fabrics to look just right at the right scale. And then from there, I mean, the materials vary almost endlessly. You know, it's all about what works perfectly for that one scene.
Right.
So you might, you know, you might be using cotton for clouds. You might be using, they get a lot, Tumbleleaf has a lot of foliage. So there's a never ending supply of different ways to produce like bushes and trees and various natural elements. You know, one thing that's popular is using flocking, which is how you give like a, one of those hard plastic little collectible horses, the way you give it a nice fine coat of hairs with flocking.
Oh.
So there are all sorts of, I mean, like, honestly, the material list is endless.
Yeah. Cause you can work with anything really.
Yeah. Anything that'll sit put while you take a picture of it.
Yeah.
I love going to the weeklies that, where you guys show the, all the work that you've done that week, because how many people work at Bix? Like, what would you say, Max?
At its peak, we're hovering right around 100. I think right now, as we're winding down, we're closer to maybe to like 40 or 60.
So you have 100 people working, you know, very long hours to produce the show, and then at the end of the week, you sit down and watch about, what, like 8 minutes of footage maybe?
Actually, you'd be surprised. At the end of the week, we can be watching up to like 20 minutes of footage.
That's true. That's true. But it's just amazing how the amount of time it takes to. You really have to be a special kind of person to be an animator, because it takes a kind of patience that a lot of people don't have, I think.
You know, people always say that, and I have never once thought to describe myself as patient. You know,
okay.
I don't know what it is, and I will admit that. The patience, maybe it's patient, the focus, I would say is the right word. My largest battle has been the focus. I grew up in the generation of ADD, and so learning to sit still and just animate, just do what you came here to do, was definitely a hurdle for me to overcome. But I think focus is applied to anything, you know? Any job, any task, anything with a level of meticulousness. I don't know if that's a word, but that anything that requires a level of attention requires focus. And I think as long as you can really maintain focus and like what you're doing along the way, then you can certainly animate.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I could see how it actually relates. I don't know why it would, why everyone seems to think it would take so much patience to animate, because really to do anything, it takes a great deal of attention to detail and a great deal of patience and meticulousness, you know, to do it well. So
yeah, there's attention and focus and a meticulous sense of each detail. These are things like attention to detail is a big thing that you learn along the way. But I think with anything else, you know, practice makes perfect, and it just takes time.
So if somebody, if you were giving advice to a younger person who wanted to get into the field of animation, what would you tell them?
Animate. That's the bottom line. Find the animation that's out in the world that inspires you. Study it like it's a fine old text, and then just animate and keep animating. At the end of the day, the only way to get better is to just keep doing it. You know, like I went to school for animation, which certainly had its values, but at the end of the day, you know, it's just putting in the hours of moving a puppet around or drawing those cells or manipulating a CG figure. But yeah, that's really, there's no secret to it. It's just to keep doing it and then to continue to do it further.
Yeah, you know, I've said that before on the podcast any number of times about people that want to get into any kind of artistic field at all, no matter whether it's filmmaking or video game making, because we do a lot of video game stuff. What you got to do is, if you want to make films, go make a film. Like, you can't. Nobody's gonna say, oh, we'll hire you to do that. You have to, for things that people really want to do, you just have to do them and then be okay at them.
That's exactly correct. My roommate and I together, we're a little studio that we call Apartment D, and we basically formed that studio because we realized that while working at other studios certainly gets you the hours and practice of making animation, it doesn't necessarily give you the practice of making films. So Sean and I have been basically nonstop since we moved out here, making our own short films, because that's where you really start to tap into your own creativity and your own filmmaking techniques and really develop your own, like, directorial style. So many people who get into animation or into film at all are like, yeah, I want to be a director. And I think there isn't quite an appreciation for what that actually means. And it just means making a bunch of terrible things until one of them's good.
That's totally true. That cannot be overstated. And it's hard, I think, for people who want to do some artistic thing but have also some level of taste to do that, because I can recognize when something I make is not very good, and it's frustrating, you know? So I get why some people have problems with that early stages where everything you make is going to be terrible. You know, like you can't undo that.
I think I forget the name now, it escapes me, but a director at Pixar put it very well. He said, it's okay to fail, but you've got to fail fast. And that's a terrible butchering of the actual quote, but the idea I think is really important. And the idea is that you will fail and you will make bad work, objectively bad work. But if you are able to move through that failure, learn from it, and continue to press forward, you will only progress.
Yeah. So
that's true.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think that's an important point.
So what's the next step? Like, if you spend all this time working on your craft and you finally have something that you're proud to show off, what's the next step? I think that you did, like, really well for yourself being able to get job after job after job once you moved out to California and took that jump. Like you were confident in your abilities, but, like, how did you, like, where did you think to look for your particular set of skills?
Well, you know, I think, it does in part depend on what your personal goals are.
Right.
Some people get into animation because they want to work at Disney or at, you know, such and such studio name, insert here.
Right.
But other people just want to be that independent filmmaker. But I guess at the end of the day, no matter what avenue or direction you're headed in, you'd like to make a little money off of it.
Right.
So for me personally, you know, I grew up in a family of people who went and got jobs. So I was like, well, I guess I'm an adult now. Time to go find a job. And so for me, that meant finding a place that did the kind of work I did. And honestly, it was as easy as a Google search.
Oh.
I just typed in stop motion studios, and that really did most of the legwork for me. From there, it was just kind of finding out what studios I liked, which studios I thought maybe I could fit in with. And then it just came down to harassing them endlessly until one of them gave me a job.
Is it a competitive field?
It's interesting because it's a very small field, so you might not think that nobody gave any craps about it. But in actuality, because it's so small, it's turned out to be quite the competitive field. I was very lucky to get in, but I've also seen many people who do not. And it's not even necessarily based on their own skills. It's just, I think luck is a combination of preparation and opportunity, and sometimes those just don't line up.
Mm. I heard today that the intersection between practice and success is luck, or somewhere another butchering of a quote, but somewhere along that line. Like, in order to cross that threshold to be, or at least consider yourself successful, it does take a stroke of luck sometimes.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, for me personally, I hunted down and found all these studios, and it just so happened that I had the skills of being able to work with metal, which were hard to come by at the time. And on top of that, there were a handful of projects starting up right as I began my search. So there was an overlap there of, like, preparation and learning the applicable skills and just, the opportunity of these studios needing people, that I would say was very lucky.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because having that one really specific skill can often be, like, if you have the one skill that most people don't have, no matter what field you're in, it's a pretty good place to be in.
You know, I moved out here to be an animator with just god awful animation skills. But I was lucky enough that I had these metalworking skills, which kind of got my foot in the door, got me meeting people, and put me in the place where I could learn the proper techniques to animate, such that when the opportunity came where I could finally potentially animate on something, I'd been able to learn from being in the industry.
Right, yeah, and you're learning from some of the best people in the industry, too, the people, the level that you were working with. I mean, those were not, you know, those are...
They're the real
they're
deal.
Good guys. Yeah, they're the real thing. They make the real stuff. So, yeah.
But then there's, you know, there's also something to be said about the tried and true practice of just hunting down your own work and freelancing. Mm-hmm. I know more than one person who's ascended to the level of director basically just from living in their parents' basement and hustling small jobs and developing their style on their own. Mm-hmm. There, one name that gets floated around a lot in stop motion is Kirsten Lepore, mm-hmm. who recently actually directed an episode of Adventure Time at Bix Fix.
Wow.
And the way she tells the story is that she just started off broke in her parents' basement trying to find any little job that would pay her to do some stop motion. And slowly through that, her style developed, her brand developed, until she became the stop motion powerhouse that she is now.
Did you work on the Adventure Time stop motion episode?
I did. That thus far may be my most favorite credit. Working on Adventure Time.
That's a pretty cool credit.
That was my I have arrived moment where I was like, I'm doing this. This just happened.
You helped animate an Oscar nominated film, and you're really proud of it. Adventure Time episode. That's awesome.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's great. Not Adventure Time is great, but
that Adventure Time episode is really good, by the way. it's really good.
I mean, I remember back in like 2008 seeing Penn Ward's original, I believe it was his college thesis. Don't quote me on that. But he made the original Adventure Time short, and I remember just being like, I don't know what this is, but this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And then a few years later, I found out that Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network was making a show out of it, and my life was forever changed.
Yeah, like it doesn't even – like if you look at that first – the first stuff that he did, what kind of vision they must have had at Cartoon Network to go, oh, yeah, that could be a series. Because yeah, I wouldn't have been able to see it.
Yeah, I've got to say Cartoon Network has been on its A game when it's come to producing – original series these days.
Yeah.
Adventure Time, the regular show, all these shows I really think are bringing forth possibly the golden age of animation, at least narrative animation.
You know, it's funny, I totally agree with you. Kids today, kids cartoons today, so much better.
Yeah,
especially when I was a kid. You guys had some good stuff when you guys were kids.
I mean, I will say Batman the Animated Series still holds the high mantle in my book.
Batman the Animated Series was a great animated series, and that was another one that was all hand-done. There was Batman Beyond, to keep on that trend. There's a whole bunch of good anime, like Gundam Wing, Dragon Ball Z, but looking back,
true.
Dragon Ball Z wasn't a very strong narrative, but it was something that we grew up with. I mean, like, it's we all sort of had those shows that are like, this is great, and then looking back on it, like, this is terrible. Kind of like
18 minutes of yelling and then 2 minutes of story.
I mean, that's Dragon Ball Z. That's anime, at least of that era.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like...
I gotta say, though, looking back, because I'm much older than you guys, clearly, hence the Old Geek, Young Geek name of the show.
Yes.
But the cartoons that we had back in the 70s are all terrible.
I mean, like, Transformers...
Really, that was like the... I don't know what the opposite equivalent of a golden age of animation was, but, like, the 70s and 80s... Whatever the crap age of animation.
Okay, but there was Transformers, there was Thundercats, there was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Those were all great on paper.
Have you seen any of those recently?
Yes, and they're bad. Like Transformers, like I tried watching it because I'm like thinking like, man, this is gonna be great, but in reality, the whole thing was just an advertising campaign for their new line of toys.
Although I will say a lot of those shows then went on to lay the foundation that modern animation is built on.
Yeah.
Shows like The Regular Show are perpetually referencing that older era of animation.
Yeah.
The style of it and like that grunginess to it where it's like, ugh, this is just ugly and weird.
Yeah.
Something about that was actually the case.
The interesting thing about Regular Show is that like it's not often addressed that those characters are adults, and
yeah.
how it just kind of is weird to be an adult when you've, you know, been a kid most of your life. So
yeah,
and that it, you are right. Like, narratively speaking, there are a lot of great shows out there. Like, Adventure Time is weird and random sometimes, but there's undertones and like a lot of themes that are really
yeah.
mature and really smart. Steven Universe is another great example of today's animation that, like,
I think that's the example at the moment.
Yeah, like, that has a very cool art style. Like, it looks like it's distinctly, like, you can tell, like, that's a Steven Universe frame, and like the narrative, the characters, they're all really well made. So yeah,
I think Adventure Time really set the stage.
Oh yeah,
for this resurgence of, like, because, you know, when you think of most shows in the 90s, you had Rugrats, you had Doug, even like Batman, all of it was like purely episodic, and there were very few plot through lines. Then all of a sudden we had shows like Adventure Time popping up, mm-hmm. and for the first time you can have not just like an episode-to-episode plot line that's continuous,
right?
But it could actually handle, like, deep, provocative concepts and, you know, occasionally just be outright dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you started getting some of that in the 90s with maybe Ren and Stimpy.
Well, I think, like, Ren and Stimpy, like, just did vulgar and weird things for the sake
I think you're selling Ren and Stimpy short.
I mean,
it's actually a super revolutionary show.
It wasn't my choice of cartoon back in the day.
What do you think?
I was definitely a divisive series. Yeah, people definitely fall on either one side of the line or the other when it comes to Ren and Stimpy. But even then, I mean, if you compare the overarching narrative of Ren and Stimpy to something like Adventure Time now, I mean, Adventure Time has shown, like, progress that sticks, you know?
Yeah,
that's true.
Episode, you watch Finn and Jake's relationship grow. Mm-hmm. Jake, Finn in appearance changes. There was a while where Finn had no arm, and he just did not have his arm for a while.
oh, yeah, that's right.
Where, you know, he got, there was a whole kind of climactic series of episodes where he fights the Lich King, and from that point on, as a character, he's a fundamentally different person because he is seen into, like, the eye of madness, if you will.
Yeah.
And now I think Steven Universe has just taken that a step further, where they are just a single storyline that is progressively moving forward.
Yeah.
Characters join the group and stay a part of the team. Another good show that does stuff like this is Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
That is another big show. I mean, they have, for example, at the end of season one, I believe, their house gets teleported away and then frozen in time. And when it returns, there's a giant crack around its foundation where it had been, like, pulled out of the earth.
Mm.
And that crack remains present for the rest of the series.
Mm.
There's even a shot where you see Morty's dad weed whacking the weeds growing up through the crack. And it's never really overtly referenced, but little details like that remain.
Yeah.
And then you compare that to something like Rugrats, where besides, like, every, you know, couple years them adding a new character, it more or less was just always an episodic series.
Right.
Right. It almost seems to mirror, like, the larger trend of television, you know?
The television is
getting more and more sophisticated.
Yeah. I mean, Breaking Bad really set the tone for this era of what some describe as the golden age of television, where
I think it's great description.
It was just a hard-pressed drama, and it was not afraid to say, if you haven't seen the last two seasons, you have no idea what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, you have to watch them.
Yeah, another great one was 30 Rock, which didn't necessarily have actually, that's not true. It really, in fact, did have these sequential narrative plot points that you could only follow by being part of the show in its entirety. And I think people want that. When you turn to television, you're not just looking for escapism. You're looking to be placed in another world. And
yeah,
they want
true.
The world to be a continuous environment.
It's funny, though, because I feel that way about a lot of shows. But then there's a lot of TV that, like, I don't watch because I'm like, well, look, I got a half an hour to commit to this.
Yeah.
I don't have a half an hour every week. I have a half an hour now, you know?
Well, yeah. We also live in the age of binge watching, which I think is shaping it a lot. You know, Steven Universe now is adopting a model of, rather than releasing a new episode each week, they are down for three months and then release like a string of five episodes that are all very heavily plot oriented.
That's kind of what you guys do on Tumbleweed as far as the release schedule goes, though, right? I mean, don't you guys put them out in blocks?
It is, yeah. And it's because people are starting to gear towards this binge watch. Nobody has time to keep up with a show every week. But if you've got a Sunday afternoon, you can just blast through it.
Yeah, well, not that, I mean, Tumbleweed, since it's, because of the age that it's for, it doesn't really have any of the kinds of things that we're talking about, I don't think, really. I mean, maybe it does, I don't know.
Not entirely, but I think it does as much as you can for a preschool series. There are definitely, I mean, there are characters that will be introduced one day and then become reoccurring. And the world shapes in a way that it becomes continuous. I can't give any spoilers for the season to come, but there are a lot of opportunities to really witness the world building upon itself, which is, I think, in its essence, the goal of a narrative storyline.
Yeah, and it's so cool. Like Tumbleweed is so cool, Scott. I know you probably haven't seen it because you don't have a younger kid around, but you should check it out anyway because I watched it because my wife works on it and because my son's a little old for it, but he still really likes it because, I mean, it's just so lush and beautiful and perfectly done that even if it's not directed toward your specific age group, you can't not appreciate the artisanship of it. Like, it's just so beautifully done
I'll say that that show really has a it has this relaxing atmosphere to it, almost like jazz music that you can put it on in the evening and just it can lull you right into bedtime. I know has been a draw for many parents to it, is whereas a show like Adventure Time, they put their kids in front of it and now the kids are just bouncing off the walls ready for an adventure. Yeah. Whereas Tumbleweed really has like this introspective quality to it where it's calming and creative at the same time, which I really appreciate about it.
Yeah, it's funny because like looking at Tumbleweed and watching it sort of critically in terms of like how it's made and where it comes from, I realized in talking to Robin about it that like personally, I don't know. I'm a writer, like I'm a screenwriter. I don't know that I could write Tumbleweed because I don't know that I could. I don't know how you kind of create the drama that it has without the danger that it lacks. You know what I'm saying? Like, it always feels relaxing. It never feels like, you never feel like something that someone is in any kind of real peril ever, but it's still intriguing to watch. And like, it's an amazing trick that the writers do on that show to get that tone.
Mm-hmm. To
move a plot without keeping it safe for somebody who is, you know, 2 years old.
Yeah, without the violence of conflicts.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot to be said about Drew, the director's vision, you know?
That guy's a genius.
The man is a genius.
And
he's
nice
been
guy.
Nurturing this baby for, I don't know, maybe almost a decade now. You know, this has been a very slow, arduous process as he built the show into what it's become now. And so I have to believe that he really has a fundamental understanding of the world and the environment and the mood that, you know, when he touches pen to paper or gives direction, he's able to bring across this predetermined entity.
Like I said, I've never seen it before, and rightfully so. I don't have a preschooler, nor am I a preschooler. But, I mean, it sounds like a very mature show in a sort of sense. Like, it's very well thought out.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's
really
cool.
I like it when the Explorer.
Right. I like it when, you know, so-called kids shows treat their audience with respect, you know? It doesn't really spell things out. I mean, like,
and what's interesting about Tumbleweed, Scott, is that a lot of the drive behind it is very basic. I don't know if it's quite science, but it's more cause and effect is always the which is something that children at that age are learning about. So the show is about like the effects that come from the things that you do and the things around you. And it's like these really, really basic things that you don't even think about the fact that one time you earned this.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what it's about. It's really fascinating.
That's good.
Yeah,
it's a good show with a good lesson to be learned.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I like, you know, it's very science driven, but at the end of the day, I think what it really pushes is, developing critical thinking in children.
Yeah.
You know, the tagline of it is, learning through play. And I think there's really something to be said about that. Teaching kids to kind of think outside the box, which I don't think is necessarily facilitated in school anymore, for example.
Hmm. I wonder, like, let me ask you, are there, educational consultants that work on the show for those kinds of lessons?
They have, I believe they have a couple, in fact. I mean, that's definitely a core element to how they produce this show. It's more, the writing team is more than simply Drew and Kelly. They have a few people that each have a specialty that really, contributes to the process. So they have, you know, an educational consultant, they have, a children's consultant, and the whole purpose of, I mean, the whole team together is what brings forth the show in its final form.
Cool. Well, Max, what should we look for if we want some, cutting-edge animation that's going on now that we might not know about?
Cutting-edge animation. Well, there are great film festivals that really are at the forefront of what's happening in animation right now. The one that I always look for is Annecy, which is a film festival in France. Tumbleleaf actually was at Annecy last year, as well as, I don't know, maybe like 5 or 6 other stop-motion films. And I know that the number of stop-motion films that you're finding now in festivals is growing, which really speaks to its growing popularity. But so
that's really cool to see, yeah.
So that is always a great place. But honestly, places like Cartoon Network right now are really pushing the envelope with artist-driven animation. So it's always really interesting to see what's happening with their, new fall lineup.
You know what? I guess that's kind of the difference between now and when I was your age. That, you know, when I was in my 20s, and if you wanted anything on the avant-garde tip at all, in anything, you really had to search it out. I mean, you had to, if you wanted animation, you had to go to, like the Spike and Mike Animation Festival, which would play, once a year somewhere. And then maybe you had a friend that would make you a VHS copy of something and be like, check this out. Where now it's like you just turn on the Cartoon Network and you're seeing, the state of the art.
Well, yeah, and then, there's also YouTube, which a lot of animators use as a platform. I remember back in high school, I would go to Newgrounds and watch, a whole bunch of Flash animators, and they would have, different, sometimes, there was there's a lot of Flash animation, but there's also, stop motion. What do you think of, Max, as, what do you think of YouTube as a platform for animators?
I think it's the platform.
Oh, yeah?
The internet has really done so much for independent artists that now that anybody who's home growing their own animation in the basement has multiple platforms to put it out there.
Right.
And, the audience is the best judge, and you'll find people who His name escapes me, but there's a British animator who does crude stop motion animations where he'll recreate famous movies. He does a recreation of The Thing with penguins.
Yeah.
And objectively, this is no mastercraft at work, but his ability to storytell and just to find that right humorous vein in people. YouTube has turned him into a star, an animation star.
Yeah.
And I think there are more and more examples of that. You know, between YouTube and Vimeo, people are getting exposure. Mm. And, by popular opinion, you find these rising stars. And I think YouTube really has done a lot for people.
That's another thing is that, that's kind of how our culture operates and, the economy of entertainment operates is that, if something goes viral, that'll really make a huge impact on the artists. Now, the thing is, with YouTube and Vimeo and, just internet, entertainment platforms is that, people sort of get popular with like consistent content creation. So
yeah.
like if and what I see a lot is that these are just like solo animators, like who
oh, yeah.
do like all the voice work, music composition, you know, every single frame of animation, and because it's just them by themselves, they really can't produce all that much content, so they kind of get left by the wayside, and you know, just flooded over by all these Let's Players and vloggers and podcasters who can easily just whip up a quick thing, you know, and upload 3 videos a day, whereas the animator might upload like once a month.
Well, you know, I agree with you to a certain extent. I think YouTube is really a mass producer's market.
Yeah.
You know, the people who can make, like, you know, you look at PewDiePie, who's like the king of YouTube, and he can put out, like you said, like 3 videos in a day, and each one will get 1 million views. The man is a powerhouse. But, I mean, for example, to go back to somebody I mentioned previously, Kirsten Lepore, she may not have the sheer volume of work on YouTube, but whenever one of her pieces of animation goes up, people take notice. And whereas PewDiePie is deriving his income directly off of YouTube, she doesn't need YouTube for income.
Right.
YouTube is just like another platform to advertise herself on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the power. It's, I mean, trying to make money off of YouTube is its own game within itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't do that in with any kind of production that takes time and effort. I mean, having
exactly.
worked for a while with a small group of people making short horror films for YouTube,
yeah.
Those films would get what anybody would consider a lot of traffic, like, you know, 100,000 views or something like that. There was no money coming in at all, and, you know, you can't make a... You know, you can't. There was like, you know, $50 a month would come in. It was like,
yeah, you've got to be on like a million view a day hustle.
Yeah,
exactly. And that you can't do if you're doing something narrative that is also time consuming and you know
right.
you can't. But if you
like,
if you stream yourself
you
playing video games,
yeah,
yeah,
you
can
demonstrate. That's a whole different skill, though. I guess you know.
Well, that's exactly right. You know. It's a kind of a to each his own situation. But just the fact that you can now anybody working out of their garage can kind of put themselves out there is terrific. And it's so easy to then turn that into actual work. I mean,
yeah.
One of the best animators on Tumbleweep right now, a guy named Michael Granberry, he started off with a YouTube series and it was crude and mass produced as all YouTube series have to be. But that was the very animation that he was able to build off of to become who he is now. And that,
yeah.
I mean, that was basically his first steps towards becoming the animator he is now.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And it's like you said earlier, like, you know, fail fast so that, you know,
exactly.
you can build on that and improve yourself. So.
And there's something to be said about how much you learn from just being in the trenches of animation. Even if you're making, you know, an episode a day animation where it's crude and fast. To be producing work is a course in its own on making films.
It's true. And another aspect of YouTube that a lot of people don't give credit for is that YouTube, not many people will be honest with you about your work because your friends and your family aren't going to be honest. But people who are commenting on YouTube are very honest. And
yes.
people who will either pay you money or not pay you money are also very honest, but those are the only people you can listen to. Everybody else
it's
don't
true.
Listen to them. They don't know.
Yeah.
So
no,
that's
it's
why
certainly
like,
true.
It hurts when you read stuff, when you read comments about your own stuff, but like, you know, I had a film that like a lot of people liked it, but a lot of people were like, oh, I could see the ending coming. And I was like, you kind of can see the ending coming. You're fucking right.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't argue with them. They're right. Okay.
Sometime you just need that hard mirror turned against
yeah.
you.
It's
yeah.
true, and YouTube will provide that in a way that is will separate the weak from the strong very quickly.
And yet, sometimes it won't. Even even on our Old Geek, Young Geek vlog, we get, like, a random comment every once in a blue moon that is just harmful without any sort of reason.
Oh, see, I should look at our blog sometime. I never do. I'm sorry, Scott.
I put so much work into that, Stephen. How dare you?
The YouTube commenters are notorious for being...
They're just
they're terrible. Yeah, they're like the meanest people in the world, no doubt. No doubt they're the meanest people in the world.
It's the children's playground out there. And everyone has access to speak directly to you with their...
But they're proportionately mean to how nice your friends and family are.
It's true.
Yeah, it's the balancing factor.
Yeah. Because my mom appreciates everything that I do.
Your mom, like, loves what you do. I understand.
My mom is great.
We gotta have your mom on. She'd be the greatest guest.
She would be. She would just say that everything that we do is great.
You know what? For Mother's Day, let's have both of our moms on.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That'd be really funny. I'd have to try and get my mom to understand Skype, though.
Well, my mom knows how to operate Skype, so we got that going for us at least. So, yeah. So
there you have it.
With that, I think that we can call today an episode. So thank you, Max, so much for joining us here, talking about animation and cartoons and storytelling and this and that. So we really appreciate having you here.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This has been great.
Before you go,
it's
Max,
it's rare that I get to geek out.
Yeah.
Amongst nice. Non-anime.
Yeah.
Before you go, though, is there any site where people can check out your stuff? I mean, you can go to Amazon.com and check out Tumbleleaf. It's easy to find. But what about your specific, any personal stuff that you want to give out a link to or anything like that?
You know, we are currently building our website. So there's nothing to see just yet, but keep your eyes peeled for Apartment D. We'll be out there.
Awesome. Apartment D, ladies and gentlemen.
Ooh,
you
cool.
Have it.
All right, well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Cool. Bye, everybody. Bye.
If you like this episode, let us know. Send us an email at oldandyounggeek@gmail.com or send us a tweet. I'm Svederik, Svederik, and Steven is Stephen A. Johnson on Twitter. That's Stephen with a PH, by the way. Thanks for listening.